Welcome to session 374 of the Sunstone Symposium 2010. This is Where is Your Faulkner? Mormon Fiction and America. I'm Albert Peck and I'm the moderator. And I just broke my glasses. Okay. In 1888, Mormon apostle Orson F. Whitney prophesied in an article titled Home Literature that we Latter-day Saints will yet have Milton's and Shakespeare's of our own. God's ammunition is not exhausted. His brightest spirits are held in reserve for the latter times. In God's name and by his help, we will build up a literature whose top shall touch heaven, though its foundation may now be low in the earth. As a freshman at BYU in 1972, I frequently heard professors and speakers quote that turn-of-the-century apostle about having Mormon Miltons and Shakespeares. And then, in 1977, in a First Presidency message in the Ensign entitled The Gospel Vision of the Arts, LDS Church President Spencer W. Kimball wrote, "For years I have been waiting for someone to do justice in recording and song and story and painting and sculpture, the restoration, the establishment of the kingdom of God on earth, the struggles and frustrations, the apostasies and inner revolutions and counter-revolutions of those first decades of the Exodus, of the counter-reactions, of the transitions, of the persecution days, of the miracle man Joseph Smith, of whom we sing, oh, what rapture filled his bosom, for he saw the living God, and of the giant colonizer and builder Brigham Young." There was a time in the mid-20th century when it looked like Mormonism was on its way to producing people who would tell the Mormon stories that interested the national audience. I'm thinking of Vardis Fisher, who wrote the Harper Prize-winning Children of God, an American Epic, and Maureen Whipple, who wrote the Houghton Mifflin Literary Prize winner, The Giant Joshua, and Virginia Sorensen, best known for A Little Lower Than the Angels, and what some consider the best Mormon novel to date, The Evening and the Morning. But after them, while there have been many fine Mormon storytellers for the Mormon market, such as Levi Peterson and Backslider, few have grabbed national attention. I once read a comment from Wallace Stegner where he said Mormons won't have good stories, good national storytellers. And some person said, "Well, you don't know Mormon literature now, like Levi Peterson. So I wrote him back and said, "Would you be willing to write an article for Sunstone about the current Mormon authors?" And he wrote me back, said he had to decline in his aged years because he had other projects to pursue. But he said, "I do want to say one thing. Being known and famous on your block is not the same thing as being famous in the country." He's my one little contact, Wallace Stegner. President Kimball's 1977 address about us having our Mormon Miltons and storytellers put the discussion of Mormon literature into hyperspace. And ever since, there have been countless articles and panels on how and when Mormons will get their Shakespeare's and Milton's. Actually, they probably are counted, and the person who probably did the counting was Gideon Burton. But personally, I'm not sure I want a Mormon Shakespeare or Milton. They're too wordy for me. I don't think I even want to read a Mormon War and Peace, but I'd gobble up a Mormon Heart of Darkness or a Mormon Catcher in the Rye. And I'd love a satirical manners comedy like Sheridan's School for Scandal. But what Mormonism is really good meat for, I think, is a brutally honest psychological family drama like Long Day's Journey into Night, or a tragic failure in the Mormon quest like a Mormon Death of a Salesman. But for the most part, the discussion of the possibilities of Mormon literature has been an insider discussion. Inside Mormonism, and who else is interested in Mormon storytelling, and it's been inside the Mormon Letters group of people. Today's panel is different. We've gathered four experts in the craft of storytelling from different fields, and they explore what would make a great Mormon novel, and that would interest both Mormons and non-Mormons alike. We have a documentary maker, a short story author, a critical theorist, and a filmmaker. These diverse perspectives will create a session of insight and breadth. So here are our speakers today. First is a paper, a 30-minute paper by Jane Barnes. Jane is a TV documentary researcher and writer. Got the wrong set of notes here. Jane is a research...
Thank you.
Beautiful introduction.
You're welcome.
Your research.
Hey, that actually helps. So. Jane here is a TV documentary researcher and writer. One of her many skills is to distill information and present it in a narrative that captures her interest while educating and provoking. Most of the people in the audience will know her work as a co-writer of the recent PBS documentary, The Mormons. She's also a published short story author and a published novelist. She's working on a book about Joseph Smith. And she'll tell you how she came to write this paper that she's going to present. After her presentation, we'll first hear from Karen Rosenbaum. A 10-minute presentation by Karen. Karen taught creative writing for 34 years at Fremont Community College in California. She's the author of many short stories on Mormon themes, and for years she was the dialogue fiction editor, which means she's thought a lot about what makes good storytelling. After Karen, we'll hear from Steve Williams. Now this is getting silly. Steve, he thinks a lot about how to effectively tell stories in film. He teaches film study at the University of Utah and Salt Lake Community College, where he and his students brutally critique what does and doesn't work in a story. He also writes screenplays and makes independent films. Many may have seen his Mormon-related short film, A Blessing, which was shown here at the symposium a few years ago. And we'll round up our panel of discussants with Ellen Wiest. Ellen has a master's degree in nonfiction writing from the prestigious program at Iowa, where she's learned a lot about the narrative theories, and she'll talk endlessly about them. Not in her presentation, maybe, but and insightfully. I never know a person who can dissect what works and what doesn't work well in the narrative arc of a story. As an entertainment journalist, she regularly ponders what makes plays and movies and novels work. I've had many long conversations with her about these on hikes and over delicious meals. She's one of the most thoughtful and insightful people I know who thinks very hard about the craft of storytelling. She's also edited a collection of fiction for Mormons called The Way We Live, which I'm sure is on sale in the bookstore. So we'll hear from Jane, and then Karen, and Steve, and Ellen.
I'm Jane. You might not know me from my introduction. that is okay, because I'm a non-Mormon, I'm an outsider. I should be little noted, although I'm going to come out, and there's a lot of big pronouncements about fiction and Faulkner and Mormons and Joseph Smith.
Yeah,
can't you hear me?
You got to eat it.
I think I just did. I am a non-Mormon writer, and my interest in this topic arose during my work as a co-writer of the PBS series on the Mormons. In our research period, I could not find the novel I wanted to read most, a novel that gave me new understanding about the saints' uneasy role in America. I assumed Mormons would be preoccupied with the subject as I was. I'd read from the Mormons' enthralling record of their long journey in soulful striving and religious ardor. It's the sort of luscious literary record that was the primal soup for novels like William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, Will Cather's My Antonia, and Kate Chopin's The Awakening. These novels dramatized regional or personal struggles in such a way that outsiders connected with people who'd always seemed other before. But I didn't find a novel of Mormon experience that crossed over in this way. I know these novels can't be produced on demand, and though I feel there's unfinished business between Mormons and Gentiles, I don't have a definitive sense of what it is exactly. Nonetheless, I think it's important to try and get at the ways Mormon experience might comment on American history and culture. Why was the relation between Gentiles and Mormons so contentious? What was in the argument for the non-Mormons? What mirror were the Mormons holding up to the rest of us that we resisted? How did the desire of the Mormons' hearts differ from the desire of our human hearts? Did their desires differ? And I think they did, but let's ask the question in a big and sweeping way anyway. The idea that the Mormons should have a distinctive fiction, as Elbert has pointed out, was part of 19th century Mormon prophecy before it became a concern of 20th century Mormon literary critics. The religious theme was considered so central or so threatened in 1974 that Neil Lambert could write that, quote, a literature or a criticism which fails to examine Mormonism on those terms is not only unfair, it is futile, unquote. By 1996, things had changed enough so that Eugene England summed up the Mormon writer situation this way. Quote, everyone wants literature that is uniquely Mormon, even Orthodox, but also good that is skillful and artful. The problem is that focusing on either quality seems to destroy the other, unquote. Things have changed again since England's important observation. The Mormon writers whose fiction I admire, and this is among other writers I've read, but there are also many Mormon writers I haven't read. So anyways, these are writers I do know, Letty Peterson and Judith Freeman and Brady Ugall and Karen Rosenbaum. They all seem to be reveling in the freedom to see Mormon experience through Mormon eyes. The church is an important backdrop in their books, but mostly passive. It's like the weather, very influential, but not asking the author to make a point. I wonder if these writers' work might open up another dimension, if their novels might be peering in the direction of the differences and what they mean between Mormons and Gentiles. What is it like to be a Mormon in a non-Mormon world? What are the pleasures and pain peculiar to living in such a divided world? Division is a great teacher. Yet, as I interviewed back and forth across the two communities for the film, I found there were many hard feelings between Mormon and non-Mormon. Hard feelings, but not much understanding. There's also a disconnect. The Mormons knew the history, and the non-Mormons did not. The Mormons had specific feelings of injury and were often defensive about them. The non-Mormons had unfounded feelings of wariness and, I'm afraid, superiority. They, and I'm referring to educated liberals in academia and out, often felt entitled to their insensitivity in ways which we would never allow ourselves to have in relation to any other important religious minority. My work is hardly a scientific sampling, but I could see that people on both sides had strong feelings that they hadn't expressed directly to each other. There hasn't been an opportunity to do so, I know, though perhaps a presidential campaign would force an airing of these resentments, and I have some interest in seeing if that happens when the Mormon presidential candidate comes along. The subversion of this sourness, if not actual ill will, also made me wonder if fiction, the medium that feeds on feelings, could be a way to express the uneasiness between Mormon and non-Mormon. Maybe even a way to find out what the antagonism is and get beyond it. At the very least, a richly explored fiction about the Mormon-Gentile divide would, I think, have the advantage of originality, the sort of originality A.O. Scott defined in his recent New York Times review of The Kids Are All Right. It is the sort of originality, he says, that provides the audience, quote, with the thrilling, vertiginous sense of never having seen anything quite like it before. Let me tell you the three areas where I found people's feelings were strongest, or the disconnect was widest. And then I'll try and suggest the bones for some stories that might tell these tales. I think we need a novel about Mormon persecution, a novel about the Mormon's search for understanding, and a novel about the Mormon's political genius. I say we need these novels because, just like in real life, the pain of these culture clashes won't go away until they're dealt with. And I don't touch on polygamy, except indirectly, because it's such a rich and complex subject, it deserves its own attention, which our Helen Flagg is going to give it. The sense that the Mormons were unfairly persecuted should be a part of our shared social consciousness. After all, as a country, we pride ourselves on our traditions of civil rights and all the ways we've faced up to our prejudices. But the injustice done to the Mormons hasn't made it into the national pantheon. I think the novel about Mormon persecution should be set during the Missouri War. It should be a moving account of the injustice done to the Mormons as they were hounded across the country, that state, and then some of the rest of the country. The point here is that the Missouri persecution was not a response to polygamy, but to the powerful sense of community that made the Mormons so different on the capitalist frontier. Actually, is this still working? Readers will have to meet and believe in a group looking for a place to practice their religion in the Wild West. The church will have to replace the saloon as the center of life. It will certainly be full of its own cast of compelling characters. We need to experience what was riveting about the Mormons, but also what was so aggravating. Yet I feel the role of the Danites should be carefully crafted. The Mormon persecution in Missouri was real, and it deserves recognition. If it were recognized in a crossover novel or film, Mormons might feel they had finally been heard. And perhaps they would also limit their sense of persecution to this real and terrible case of it. Meanwhile, non-Mormons might actually hear them and hear this fact, especially if they are brought into the situation through one of their own. We would meet General Alexander Doniphan, a Gentile who was a tough fighting man and someone whose sympathy for the Mormons came from hard-won experience. I think it's an incredibly interesting fact that Doniphan started his career dealing with the Heatherly Gang, a group of white Missouri men who'd raised the alarm against thousands of Indians for crimes they themselves had committed. Doniphan was part of a militia sent to expel the Indians from the state, and he was among those who realized the Indians had been set up by the Heatherlys. Later, he saw the Mormons were also being unfairly set up and gave the Mormons legal help in their early conflicts with Missouri. When Joseph Smith turned himself in to end the war, Doniphan accepted Smith's surrender. He stood by when Joseph was treated as a prisoner of war, despite the fact that no terms had been agreed upon. Joseph was paraded through lines of mocking soldiers and made to sleep on the ground in the rain. A court-martial was held during the night, and Joseph was illegally sentenced to be executed in the morning. But when Doniphan was given the order, he refused to commit what he called cold-blooded murder. Joseph's surrender and Doniphan's disobedience are culminations any novelist would die for. I only hope their outsized acts are rendered so a general American audience realizes the settling of the West has not yet been fully told. When the Mormons are driven out of Missouri, they're treated with more contempt than the Native Americans who Doniphan helped at the beginning of his career. He was able to prove those Indians were unfairly charged, but no one could save the Mormons. Why not? What put these religious pilgrims beyond the pale? Where did the Missourians get their confidence to treat other white men like devils? My second crossover novel would deal with the Mormon search for understanding and the public relations problem of Joseph Smith. A founding prophet should break the mold, and Joseph Smith did. He is the shock of the new and reminds us that God is strange, terrifying, beyond our comprehension. Whether knowingly or not, however, I think many Mormons are up against the non-Mormon prejudice against Joseph's truly unconventional character. Gentiles are outraged or confused that a prophet should be so mercurial, irreverent, and experimental. And at the same time, they're not very committed to learning more about him. There is a renowned 19th century encounter between an untitled New England aristocrat and Joseph Smith, which could put an old storytelling device at the service of having non-Mormons become more understanding of Mormons. According to this setup, an outsider makes his way into a sacred city which has forever been off limits and slowly but inexorably falls under the spell of the exotic inhabitants. In 1843, Josiah Quincy and Charles Francis Adams spent a day with Joseph Smith in Nauvoo. Both Easterners were dripping in unconscious snobbery and resistance to the unfamiliar, the emotional, and the revelatory. Having never been out west, their idea of adventure was to go first to Quincy, Illinois, in Adams County, named after Josiah's illustrative relative, John Quincy Adams. There, the two men met Dr. Goforth, whose name could not have been more called for. Quincy and Adams needed to get out of their New England ghetto. And Dr. Goforth took them down the Mississippi to meet his friend Joseph Smith. At the time of his visit, Quincy was horrified by the prophet. 40 years later, when he wrote up his notes and published them as recollections, he had come to appreciate that it was easy to dismiss Joseph, yet impossible not to admire much that he had accomplished. Quincy's recollections could be reconfigured so that the 40 years begin in 1841, say, and are compressed into 3 or 4 years while a snobby young New Englander is transformed by what he learns about Joseph Smith and his people in the run-up to Joseph's murder by the mob at Carthage. Quincy provides us with plenty of rich material to work with. He puts the prophet before us in all his extremes. We meet him talking sense about the cruelties of Missouri and then moving matter-of-factly to the divine grandeur of his own revelatory powers. He takes his visitors to the Hall of Curiosities. There, Joseph shows them the mummies and hieroglyphs, which he claims are signed with the autograph of Moses, a fact we now know Joseph fabricated. The hero will wonder, as Quincy does, whether Joseph is mad. If he is insane, how can he mean so much to the many people who mob him wherever he goes? How can he have conceived of the Nauvoo Temple or envisioned the utopian religious community on the Mississippi? Quincy finally asks Joseph whether it isn't dangerous for one man to have so much power. Smith replies in what Quincy calls, quote, a richly comic tone, unquote, saying, and this is Joseph's quote, in your hands, or that of any other person, so much power would no doubt be dangerous. I am the only man in the world in whom it would be safe to trust with it. Remember, I am a prophet. Such a statement is wildly provocative and interesting. What does his irony mean? Does it reflect Joseph's sense of the gulf between his truth and Quincy's? Does it reflect Joseph's sense of the place of religion in 1843? In his behavior and his statements, Joseph often suggests that being a prophet was like being a realist painter after realism was declared dead. There is so much of the experimental modern artist in Joseph. Signs of his fluidity are everywhere in Quincy's description of their encounter. It's Joseph's strangely forward-thinking, seat of the pants, learning your art as you go modernism that I think holds the key to making sense of Joseph Smith. In the crossover novel I Envision, the outsider narrator will see Joseph's irony as something new in a God, in a world where God is dying. We have always thought in terms of faith and doubt, but perhaps an alternating rhythm between faith and irony is a necessity to being religious in our contemporary world. Finally, I feel we need a novel about the Mormons' political genius, nowhere more tested than during the early 20th century period of assimilation. No one's come up with a hard or fast explanation of how the Mormons provoked controversy in the communities where they settled. We know they rubbed their neighbors the wrong way at times, but the saints also learned how to please. When they sent Senator Reed Smoot to Washington in 1902, they showed incredible finesse and diplomacy. It's one of the great American success stories, brilliantly recounted by Kathleen Flake in Politics of American Religious Identity. Her book is a richly layered account of the vivid clash of cultures during the years of the Smoot hearings, and my own sense of the events is largely shaped by hers. Since the scene is Washington, D.C., the dramatic conflict between the prophet Joseph F. Smith and his congressional interrogators is a mighty showdown between Zion and Babylon. Professor Flake sets up a dramatic center in which Mormon and Gentile characters oppose each other on polygamy and marriage, deception and truth, religion and politics. We encounter a starchy yet lively President Joseph F. Smith, who was the beard of an Old Testament patriarch, 5 wives and 48 children, 11 of them, I believe, born after the manifesto that was supposed to end polygamy. His testimony about whether Mormon polygamy actually stopped in 1890 belongs in the heaven of split hairs, along possibly with the famous quote, "It depends on what the meaning of is," unquote. Though President Smith wanted to end Mormon isolation and was ready to newly enforce the prohibition against polygamy, he did not want to reject the practice theologically or censure Mormons who'd taken new wives after 1890 or explain how he had children with women no longer supposed to be joined to him in spiritual wifery. Yet he was asked embarrassing questions about each of these points and had to dance as fast as he could to lead his people to higher ground. Then there is Senator Smoot himself, an apostle, a monogamist, a businessman, religious but worldly too. Smoot handled the situation by saying as little as possible and forging a mantle for his own protection, one senator at a time. The other Mormon who could carry an important stripe of history in this novel is called Carl Badger, Senator Smoot's up-and-coming secretary. Badger was young enough not to have realized that many in the Mormon leadership had been practicing polygamy in the wake of the 1890 manifesto. He was disillusioned, but he also chomped at the bit when two apostles were forced to resign because of their plural wives. It went against his grain that these men who had believed in this so firmly and so deeply should be punished. Finally, since the real controversy around seating Smoot was Mormon polygamy revisited, this novel would need at least one Washington senator who was involved in an adulterous affair. Do the Smoot proceedings affect the way this wayward senator thinks about a situation? Or will he be the person who said, and one senator did say this, quote, "I think the Senate would prefer a polygamist who doesn't polyg to a monogamist who doesn't monog," unquote. In our country, where adultery is common and apparently very popular in the Senate, why was polygamy such an offense? I don't know what the uproar about the adultery polygamy clash is really all about, but it is one of those clashes between Gentile and Mormon which stirs up passions from the deep. One of the reasons I wish a novel could help limit Mormon paranoia to persecution on the frontier is that I feel the clash about polygamy may have some persecution in it, and it does. But that shouldn't obscure the other powerful elements at work, like sexual freedom and sexual oppression, honesty about sex and freedom, and the fragility, for instance, of the Victorian family at the time. Senator Smoot was seated once the two apostles were regretfully given up. There was something exquisitely painful in this victory. In this, as in other Mormon and Gentile clashes, there's also something big at stake. The role of the community, the place of religion, the limits of the state. I gave you some bones, and now I'm suggesting these muscly issues as part of the new Mormon fiction I hope will be written. But these clashes also stir deep passions. Mormons and non-Mormons have felt strongly enough to kill each other over their conflicts. Why? I'm not sure. But I do feel a great white whale of truth deep below my surface when I try and think about the answer. I'd like to have a better understanding of that truth before I'm through. I sense these clashes are heart-to-heart arguments about who we really are, the bones and gristle and organ meat of the primal soup in which great fiction simmers. And I believe that when Faulkner suits up for reincarnation, he will request to be reborn to Mormons now living in Salt Lake City, with ties back to Joseph Smith and Danites and the Missouri War, in a family with ancestors in the pioneer trek, a polygamist in the closet, and a young Mormon feminist organizing against an ACLU suit against the church for violating its not-for-profit status through aggressive politicking against same-sex marriage.
It was wonderful, Jane. I am a Mormon short story writer, not a novelist, so my version of Jane's question might be, where is our Isaac Bashevis singer? Short stories by Mormon writers have won national attention and major awards, but I acknowledge the reverberations of a short story collection are rarely equal to those of a novel. Many years ago, the Western historian and novelist Wallace Stegner told me he did not think a Mormon novel could become a bestseller. It takes too much explaining, he said. Stegner, who knew Mormons as an outsider living among them during his adolescence and early 20s, didn't require the explanations. But as my teacher, he told me if my stories needed them. I learned to write short stories that I felt Mormons could think of as Mormon stories, and non-Mormons could think of as just stories. Perhaps because they are generic, and perhaps because they have lacked that clashing originality of which Jane speaks, most of my stories have not become sellers at all, much less bestsellers. Many of those stories, however, have been received quite well in the small community of which I am part. Arts and humanities-minded people who have some connection to Mormonism. This community is not represented by the official church, which has little use for fiction, though it does condone stories, preferably autobiographical, that can be considered faith-promoting. I want to respond specifically to the three areas that Jane insightfully feels might inspire Mormon novels. Novels that she feels America needs to narrow the disconnect between Mormons and non-Mormons. I will discuss each briefly in reverse order. I'm going to be asking questions, and I promise no answers. First, one caveat. Jane's points and examples are drawn from a rich Mormon history. But most of us now writing fiction do not write historical fiction. We might go back to the 20th century, but not the 19th. It's not that we are incapable of research, most of which has been done for us. It is that we are more concerned with the world of now. I will try to apply Jane's proposals to that contemporary world. Jane suggests we need a novel about the Mormons' political genius in the battle for assimilation. I agree. This concept teems with potential. I hope someone tackles the difficulties of reconciling the desires of many Mormons to be both a peculiar and an assimilated and politically significant people. Here we see at least one example of historical fiction. Joseph Smith is a much more promising character for a novel than Thomas Monson. Besides being young, striking, charismatic, and powerful, he boasts such fierce loyalty from his followers and antipathy from his enemies. He was Brother Joseph, not President Smith. Neither a novel set in the 19th century nor the 21st would have to focus on the prophet, but it would still be much harder to cast Joseph Smith as a minor character than President Monson. Still, in any time period, a point of view character might be a less obvious person, perhaps the child or wife of someone ambitious for political influence. One could write also about those affected by the institutional church's forays into politics in the 20th and 21st centuries, the ERA and gay marriage controversies, for example. Might such a political story help non-Mormons and Mormons better understand each other? Some of these conflicts could incorporate parts of the other two themes that Jane explores. Jane suggests we need a novel about the Mormons' search for understanding in their own country. These struggles could take place in the past or the present. Modern Mormon writers can and do probe the desires of peculiar individuals to be understood and accepted and even loved by those less peculiar. The friction might come because the Mormons' beliefs or practices are regarded with hostility or indifference by a non-Mormon individual or group. A young person with a strong testimony that Joseph Smith was what he purported to be confronts a teacher who dismisses that history. Perhaps the teacher repudiates the entire foundation of the student's beliefs. dismissing, beginning with the existence of God. How do the student and teacher influence each other? We are used to the student's story. What about the teacher's? A woman who upholds traditional Mormon views on celibacy outside marriage is in love with a man who finds such views incomprehensible. Can we see both their viewpoints? How does each affect the other? A Mormon grandfather finds that he and his values are lampooned or ignored by all the young people he knows, including his grandchildren. How do he and they handle this polarity? How do these conflicts play out if the non-Mormons used to be Mormons? Is there a way to write these stories so that Mormons and non-Mormons and former Mormons will better understand each other? The version of these conflicts in which an outsider comes into the community or communities and gets a crash course in Mormonism and Mormondom might best be written by someone like Jane. I suspect she knows as much about Mormon history now as many Mormon fiction writers. Jane suggests we need a novel about Mormons persecuted and persecuting, and she supplies some fine historical examples. Rarely would current examples involve the physical violence common in 19th century Mormon history. Most current persecution stories involving Mormons would be, at least in part, political. The Proposition 8 dissension in California provides examples of some Mormons seeking to limit the rights of homosexuals who feel persecuted. In turn, some Mormons feel persecuted in the controversy too, complaining that the outing of financial support for Proposition 8 has led to harassment and, in some instances, loss of jobs. Could a novel treating these persecutions further understanding? Or would one side appear to be so much more sympathetic than the other that the sides would distance themselves even more from each other? In the past 25 years especially, there have been visible examples of some Mormons persecuting other Mormons, those whose beliefs and sometimes practices are different from their own. In some cases, more traditional Mormons have regarded the less traditional as dangerous, deviant. Some of these less orthodox Mormons view the more orthodox with ridicule and sarcasm. The less orthodox Mormons all too often jump ship, and the cost of leaving may be high for them and their loved ones. And perhaps the traditional Mormons who have watched their opponents either floundering about in the water or setting off with strong strokes for land, perhaps those still on board could have second thoughts about their part in the desertion. Could these conflicts find their ways into Mormon novels that would, one, appeal to many readers, and two, help non-Mormons see Mormons as having qualities with which they could identify? This introduces a doubtful subject for a persecution novel, but an important persecution issue. Some Mormon writers feel that they have been persecuted by non-Mormons in the publishing field. The Eastern establishment has not often welcomed Western writing, and Mormon writing has been considered even less desirable. Where, a publisher asks, is the audience for such writing? Faulkner didn't have to answer that question. Many non-Southerners are interested in reading about the South. Singer didn't have to answer that question either. Even if Gentiles, here I mean non-Jews, not non-Mormons, weren't interested in reading about Jews, the number of well-read Jewish readers guarantees a sizable reading audience. A lot more Jews are willing to read things that may not be good for the Jews. Then there are Mormons willing to read things that may not be good for the Mormons. And people who have been interested in Mormons have often not been willing to read fiction about Mormons. As I said, I have not sought to write Mormon stories. I have sought to write stories about conflicts which have shaped and which have shaken me. Many of my characters are or have been Mormons, though this may not always be obvious to a non-Mormon reader. My stories are replete with quandaries about spiritual belief. Some of my characters stumble about in a world in which God does not often visit. Some have the desire to believe in deity, in an afterlife, in Mormonism, but the inability to believe in these things. They may wish God were there. They may be grateful that their loved ones can have the comfort this belief affords them. They often are trying to empathize with both those who believe more and those who believe less than they do. In the light of Jane's paper, I've tried to analyze anew my own motives for writing fiction. I write to give meaning and order to my time on Earth. I write to explore the adventures and misadventures of life. I write to determine what I think, what I believe. And yes, I write to understand and to be understood, to try to bridge the breach between the Mormon and the non-Mormon world.
Well, I come to this as a filmmaker, and my question would be, where are our Mormon Coen brothers? That's what I would like to see, personally. I love the A.O. Scott quote that Jane used about the kids are all right, the vertiginous sense of seeing something you've never seen before. I'd like to hopefully develop that further in relationship to Mormon film. And my presentation, I'm telling it using the three-act structure that we use in screenwriting. Everybody hear me? Okay, act one, what I've learned from fortune cookies. Several years ago, after dining in a Chinese restaurant, I cracked open my fortune cookie on the way out the door. The fortune read, "Life is a tragedy for those who feel, and a comedy for those who think." I generally get fortunes like, you will go on a long journey, or you will have many friends, or you will attract great wealth. I've never received a fortune that was actually useful to me. I tape this one up on the wall in the room where I write, and I think about it almost every day. Life is a tragedy for those who feel, and a comedy for those who think. When Jane first called and spoke to me about being part of this panel, she asked me what I would like to see more of in Mormon cinema. My answer was immediate: more comedy. I told her I thought Mormon cinema should be a lot funnier, but a dark sort of funny. We both laughed at the idea, and here I am today. Now, I don't mean broad comedy or slapstick or romantic comedy, all worthy subgenres. I'm talking dark comedy, black comedy. Think Fargo, think Network, think Little Miss Sunshine, Harold and Maude, Fight Club, The Producers, Citizen Ruth, Election, anything by Quentin Tarantino, anything by the Coen brothers, think Jonathan Swift, think Molière. In black comedy, the world is flawed, unfixable. The characters are mostly unlikable. Story is subversive. As soon as you think everything's under control, here comes the tornado. When not to be negative at all, but, you know, when I think of Mormon films, I think earnest, beautiful, cute, life-affirming, moral, inspiring, clear, earnest. Did I say that already? These are wonderful qualities. There's nothing wrong with them. But I generally don't find myself surprised by the content of Mormon films. I'm rarely shocked by anything. I never use the adjectives absurd, heretical, creepy, scathing when I describe what I've seen. And if I'm being completely honest, I usually wait until these films arrive at the dollar theater before I'll see them. Wouldn't it be a breath of fresh air to laugh at something in a Mormon film and actually feel a little guilty for laughing about it? In the finale of Little Miss Sunshine, it's set at a beauty pageant for little girls. The finale is pure chaos, absurd, almost obscene. But I can't remember a more memorable sermon on the evils of the beauty contest mentality that has crept into the American psyche. The film scolds, but oh so entertainingly. I'm in the process right now of writing a dark comedy. I've never written one before. Almost all of my own films, short films thus far, have been pretty heavy dramas. I'm getting tired of people telling me, I know someone who needs to see your film, as if my film were spinach, or medication or something. But as I'm writing this comedy, I find myself retreating into the old, familiar territory, trying to wring tears rather than generate guilty laughs. It's hard changing one's tone. hard, at least for me, to invent characters who are devoid of conscience, hard to end a film in chaos rather than resolving everything. I always feel like I'm swimming upstream, but I'm having a marvelous time. Another confession. I've worked on the same screenplay, turning out one draft or another, for many, many years. A bunch of you in this room know that and have read those drafts. The script was very earnest in tone, controversial in topic, and highly emotional. I thought it was a masterpiece. When I finished, I asked a well-known Mormon writer to review it. I eagerly awaited her response, sure that she would heap praise upon my head. Her reply came in an email. It read, "Very strong story, but it feels like it was written for Mormons, and they won't see it." Hard words for me to hear. I was devastated, but she was absolutely right. It was some of the best advice I had ever received. When you're writing something that you feel a certain group needs to see, to set them straight, whatever, it's probably highly unlikely that they'll ever see it. You can't make them watch it, and if we're merely preaching to the choir every time, what's the point? Act two, what I've learned from my students. I've been teaching film for 10 years now. I show a feature film in class each week following my lecture. In the first couple of years of teaching, I'd always have a few students who would leave the classroom as soon as the lights went down, sure that the film was going to be boring because I was showing mostly classics. It really bugged me. So I began assigning a one-page weekly journal, personal response to the film, a way of assuring that they would stay to the end of class. Well, it worked. But now I had 90 papers to read every week. And I dreaded the task until I actually started reading them. They were fascinating. I teach intro to film. I teach a couple of classes. One of them is intro to film, one I'm talking about now. My students at this level, this intro level, it's a general ed class, they feel no obligation to like anything that I show them. They've always seen entertainment, or film as entertainment, not art. If they're not entertained, they scream bloody murder. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, "I want those 2 hours of my life back." But, they also tell me when they love something, something moves them, delights them, surprises them. It's thrilling for me, though I'd never admit it to them, because I tell them I don't care if they like it or not, but in truth I do. It's thrilling for me to see them discover and embrace great films, even one shot in black and white. 2 weeks ago I showed Sunset Boulevard, and they loved it. It blew them away. They're hungry for great stories. Not surprising, really, because they hardly ever get a chance to see them. Seems like we've stopped making great films. And that's a generalization, but I think it may be true. Here's what my students hate. Clichés, predictable plots, plots that go nowhere, films that preach, characters that don't change, films with overwrought, sappy music, lack of style, films with an axe to grind. On the other hand, they love to be surprised. They love suspense. They love great characters, and they love films that ooze with style. And they especially love not knowing what's going to happen next. Okay, Act 3, very short here. What I've learned from successful films that deal with religion. I think there are films that have done religion pretty well. Hollywood mostly avoids them. They're a tough sell. Indie films treat religion, for the most part, with utter contempt. Yet The Passion of the Christ raked in over $600 million worldwide, and that's from a production budget of only $30 million. So there's definitely a market for these films, but there are few that are able to find it. I'd like to give two examples of films that I thought were successful in dealing with religious films. And I'm not necessarily talking box office. I'm talking about films that took a religious film or religious theme and turned it into something memorable, something artistic. First is a redemption story called New York Doll, released in 2005. I'm sure many of you have seen it. It was directed by a Mormon, Greg Whiteley. I believe he was the home teacher of Arthur Kane, former member of the 80s glam rock group, the New York Dolls. His subject, Arthur, after a life of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and a suicide attempt, converts to Mormonism, then reunites with his former band members for a concert 30 years later. What I love about this film is its juxtaposition of elements that don't belong together. The film is full of such surprises. One of my favorite moments is an interview with two sweet little Mormon ladies at the Los Angeles Family History Center, with whom Arthur is now working daily. They're adorable. They giggle, speak in hushed, modest tones about the unlikelihood of their rubbing shoulders with a real rock star. Another favorite moment happens right before the reunion concert in Royal Albert Hall. It's evident that all the band members have accepted Arthur's choice to convert to Mormonism. There's no sign of tension, anti-Mormonism, derision, only love. They form a circle holding hands as Arthur offers up a simple pre-concert prayer. It's a transcendent moment. After I showed this film to my class, I always ask, was this film directed by 1, professional filmmaker, 2, professional musician, or 3, a Mormon? Almost invariably, they vote professional musician. So kudos to Whiteley. Though the film is certainly faith-promoting, we don't feel a heavy director's hand. The other film is a true black comedy, totally different from New York Doll. A Serious Man, released in 2009, was made by the Coen brothers, who are my heroes. It's a retelling of the story of Job set in 1962 Minnesota, and it's made about $30 million to date, so that's respectable. Larry, a respectable middle-aged Jewish man, is our protagonist. His life has recently started to fall apart. His wife is demanding a divorce, he's being blackmailed by a student at school, and his chances of gaining tenure at the college where he teaches are being threatened. He begins a desperate search to know the reasons why God is punishing him. His genuine anguish, is perfectly juxtaposed against the orderly conformity of suburban 1960s. And as always with the Coen brothers, the spot-on visual design tells half the story. Of course, he never finds the answer to his questions. In fact, the film's theme is life is a mystery. If you want to be happy, don't ask why. Most of the film is hilarious, tongue-in-cheek, but there are scenes that are devastating. The protagonist's brother, Arthur, is a homosexual man portrayed as a complete misfit in this sanitized 1962 world. One night, Arthur sits at the edge of an empty pool in a motel parking lot, unburdening his soul to Larry, the protagonist, cursing his own existence, raging against a God who has given him no chance for happiness. It's quite a daring move for the Coens to put this scene in the middle of a film that's supposed to be a comedy. But the scene adds depth and poignancy to the film, again, turning it, I think, into a piece of art that is deeply philosophic and existential. In conclusion, thanks for indulging me while I spout off about my favorite films and favorite genre. Let me just say that I applaud anyone who can get a feature film made and funded. I'll pay you to tell me your secret. I'm in awe of some of the excellent work that has already been done by Mormon filmmakers. But it's funny, we all are touching on this. I'm imagining a film about all the fuss surrounding Proposition 8. I can see it, opposing viewpoints, fervent praying on both sides, yelling and screaming, families torn apart, passionate speeches, emotions high on voting day, outcome of the vote, hailstorm of criticism and hatred, and then Judge Walker turns the tables by throwing it out. Sounds like a comedy to me. I mean, which would you rather see? Would you rather see a drama about that or a comedy? Personally, I'd rather see a black comedy. I think we all need to laugh about this issue. And that's a film I would gladly pay full price to see. Thank you. I love you.
Good afternoon. To buy my way onto this panel, I came up with a very fancy title, and I'd like to read it to you now, and then I'm going to totally discard it. My title is The Emerging Mormon Voice: Have Contemporary Polygamy Stories Opened the Back Door for Crossover Novels? So it's really fancy, and now I'm going to drop that tone. But I brought visual aids here, and because I'm a journalist, I'll mention this later. We believe that you come up with three of anything, and you can write a trend story. And so I have my three right here, and I'll put them right here. I want to thank Jane for a very thoughtful act of speculative literary criticism. I think it's a new genre. I think we should all practice it.
So many books have been written about it.
And I'm speaking on this panel because I want to read novels like those she's outlined and more. As a reader and writer, I was shaped by growing up Mormon, female, and in the non-Utah West. As a young, ambitious reader, I was drawn to read and reread a book called Wilderness Bride. It was a young adult novel about a teenage Mormon girl, Corey, crossing the plains on the Mormon Trail. Because it's out of print now and hard to get a hold of, and I know this because I searched for it for years on Amazon, I'll spoil the plot for you. Corey eventually elopes, not with the polygamist that the old people in her religion wanted her to marry, but the rebellious, young, handsome British guy, Ethan. I was drawn to this story because of what I knew about my own family history, my mother's Oregon Trail pioneers, whom I learned about in school, and my father's Mormon Trail pioneers, who I sung about in primary, and I was the kind of kid who got those all mixed up. I've been thinking about that story from my girlhood again recently as a rash of polygamy novels have landed on my desk at the Salt Lake Tribune. As I said about trends, so we've written trend stories about these. But I'm here to talk about this trendy rash of polygamy novels, and two in particular. David Eberhoff's The 19th Wife and Brady Udall's The Lonely Polygamist. We can thank Mitt Romney's presidential campaign and HBO's Big Love for the fact that these nationally published novels came weighted with timeliness and the journalistic stamp of newsworthiness. And in case you wonder about that, I brought two articles from today's papers. The headline in the Deseret News was "Unfavorable Views of LDS Rampant," and about a national poll that says that the people who know about Mormons don't like them. And then from my own paper, reality show to star Utah polygamists, about TLC is launching a new series about Cody Brown and his three sister wives called Sister Wives. So, reality show about polygamists. When these polygamy novels came to me, they both were published by separate publishing houses, and they both had the same line that I thought was very funny in the press release, and then they claimed both of them to be not anti-Mormon books, and not was in all capital letters. As journalists, again, when people capitalize things, we dismiss that and cross it out. Consider how mainstream Mormons have so often swept aside polygamy stories, labeling them as the other. Splinter groups, cults, fundamentalists, polygs, whatever. They are giving us a bad name. Yet in these recent novels, polygamy seems to function as a cultural umbrella, providing shade for characters who are more than religious zealots, more than earnest optimists. I'm interested in considering how Mormon writers might capitalize on the interest in polygamy as a backdoor to a wider crossover audience. If this proves true, what an irony, that what the LDS Church has tried to bury in our history could provide a springboard for an emerging Mormon literary voice. Not Mormons telling stories to each other, or Mormons telling stories to outsiders, but more simply, writers telling stories rising from the emotional truth, the emotional lived truth that they were born to tell. The truth. That's where things get complicated for Mormon fiction writers, I believe. There's an interesting paradox in the idea of creating literature that's built on describing the ineffable, that's rooted in explicating the spiritual. There are contradictions for any writer who ascribes to the plan of salvation and believes in a true church, and yet undertakes an artist's journey of danger. Rilke described it as living the question. I would suggest no cloak of faith can protect us on that march of danger. Everyday life and the human condition sets us all on that course anyway. When I read Mormon stories of any stripe, or for that matter, Jewish or Unitarian stories, I'm always interested in the same thing. I'm interested in cultural, ethnic, and religious characters who have been created with, and I'm quoting here, the same privilege of texture, of self-contradiction and error, and thus tragic force as white people. And this comes from a line from the critic Joan Osceola from a recent New Yorker essay. And so I give that to you as our challenge. Let's write about Mormons with the same tragic force as white people. Perhaps this literary task feels complicated by the ongoing political conversation here in Utah, where our cultural self-consciousness is complicated by the Mormon-non-Mormon divide. This is disturbingly evident every day in the reader comments on articles on the Tribune and other news websites. And on the other side of the Zion Curtain, if people know of Mormons at all, we are universally stereotyped for our spiritual earnestness, dismissed for being as optimistically naive as pioneers, or simply as kooks with our own Bible. Which is why I think that these two polygamy novels are so timely to the discussion of emerging Mormon voices. In considering these, I'm interested in this question. Is it possible to identify literary footprints of cultural authenticities in these stories? And if there is such a thing as cultural authenticity in these stories, does it prove that there might be an audience for well-told Mormon stories that include or don't include polygamy? So, to the books. First, in 2008, came Ebershoff, The 19th Wife. It's a postmodern historical novel, and by that I mean the narrative is littered with bits and pieces of authentic appearing artifacts and documents and a variety of historical voices. In an interview, the author said to me he wanted to create a structure that would prompt a conversation within the book itself. I realized, depending on whose point of view, this story is different, the author said. His book is the story of a woman who is based on the real-life story of Eliza Ann Young, Brigham Young's most famous disaffected ex-wife. Like an iPod set on shuffle, that frame story contrasts with a contemporary murder mystery set among a fundamentalist polygamous sect. The mystery story is told by a character named Jordan Scott, an adult lost boy who returns to southern Utah to try to solve the murder of the prophet, which his mother, who also happens to be a 19th wife, was jailed for. Oh yes, and Jordan Scott also happens to be gay with a sarcastic sense of humor and a potty mouth that makes him seem like a redneck version of Holden Caulfield. The very smartest choice in this book is how Ebershoff has fused a historical story with a mystery. That provides a frame that allows his characters to grapple with large questions about mysteries of religious faith. Beyond its structure, the novel offers metaphoric moments that might be illuminating for Mormon writers, and for that matter, non-Mormon readers. One example is when Ebershoff explains why Jordan's boyfriend, a gay former Mormon, still wears temple garments of a religion he doesn't practice anymore. Tom describes his mother's description of garments as feeling like, quote, wearing a hug. Later, as Jordan watches Tom sleep, he sees the garment's navel marker. It's there to remind you of God's nourishment or something like that. It's just a little dash of thread, and as Tom and I fell toward sleep, I rubbed it over and over the way a finger returns impulsively to a scar. Brady Udall's novel was published in May of this year. The Lonely Polygamist is the ambitious yet everyday story of a southern Utah contractor, Golden Richards, who has four wives and 28 children, everybody struggling through the Jimmy Carter years. The story is told through the points of view of Golden, his youngest wife, Trish, and the 11-year-old son, Rusty. He's son number 5, and he's labeled the family terrorist. After a while, it feels like everybody is getting a word in. Even the family's houses get to speak up for a chapter or three. There's also a nuclear bomb explosion that is anthropomorphized. One thing I find deeply Mormon in this novel, almost cellular, is how its characters are drawn together by the community of family. Some characters execute conflicted exits from the church, balanced by complicated characters who stay. Another example, to me, of Mormon sensibility is the idea of the story's central complication, which is a not-quite-consummated affair. And not to spoil the plot for you, but now I'm convinced that every self-respecting polygamy story should end with a wedding. For all its wry humor, this novel is deeply anchored in, it's not religious faith, because Udall skirts the character's why to explore their hows. Instead, the story is anchored in the pain and losses of parenting and the complicated relationships between men and women. And they are complicated, let me assure you of that. As a reader and writer, I hope to learn from the writer's generosity towards his characters. I'm intrigued by his mix of comedy and tragedy and how closely he puts elements of those together. And I'm drawn by a sly skill at embedding cultural grenades that will later explode in comic, delicious ways. One example comes when Golden tries to confess his affair to the leader of the church, and Golden stops himself because he realizes what a disappointment he is to the church. He remembers a time 10 years earlier when he was considered the one mighty and strong. The way Udall uses that scriptural prophecy to humanize his schlub of a character pays off again in a later scene, in which Golden recalls how his first wife used to irreverently, very irreverently, invoke that title as she turns toward him in bed. "Where is my big man, the one mighty and strong?" she asks him. And I'm very interested as a reader in that kind of cultural familiarity that can turn prophecy to an intimate joke that further defines character. When I think about these two books together, it's interesting to me how alike these books are in their ambition and in their epic, sprawling stories, and yet how differently they tell chapters in the grand drama of polygamy. When I think about The 19th Wife, I'm impressed by the novel's scope and how its structure eases many of the problems of writing a historical novel for contemporary readers. But over the course of the book, the characters started to seem less real, more like mouthpieces for an ongoing argument. Too many voices, too many pseudo-historical documents, too much truthiness. Yet the novel's central characters didn't ring emotionally true. They felt crafted out of research, like if they were trying to convert me to the novel's ideology. This is the character who represents the insider view of polygamy. This is the character who shows its horrific underbelly. Yet the characters didn't, to me, have the sweet contradictions of real people. When I think about The Lonely Polygamist, I remember how it felt to be caught up in that big, sprawling story, a story that I had grown up with and a story that I hadn't thought much about the complications of. There were such funny scenes, I had to read it aloud to my husband. My first husband, that is, because I only have one. I forgot that I was reading about capital P polygamous and instead got caught up in the daily arguments, lies, and confusion of one supersized family. The characters began to feel like people I knew. No one was trying to convert me of anything. These lives were messy, complicated, very, very different than mine, very, very human and universal. So what's the point? Perhaps this is just a long-winded exercise to say, these two books offer a reminder of the possibilities in fiction, the possibilities for anything a writer can pull off. By that I mean, Mormon writers of all stripes face the challenge of writers everywhere. Every literary convention can be trumped by a writer's craft and strikingly fresh insights, especially when stories are rooted in deep cultural knowledge. Write me the story of an oxymoronic Mormon like a gay lost boy or a polygamist who has an affair. Engage me with ambitious structure, textured scenes, complexity that arises out of specificity, and jolts of truth in the precision of your language. Do this, then as a reader, I will follow your artful narrative anywhere, and I mean anywhere, no matter how many or few wives your characters has. Thank you.
They were just for show.
This is so cool. Perfect time.
Okay. Let's see if the panelists first want to make any comments after hearing everyone speak, and then we'll open it up for a conversation with everyone here. Anyone have something they'd like to say?
I wanted to ask Ellen, do you feel that the polygamous novels help, as Jane was helping non-Mormons and Mormons to better understand one another?
I would say yes and no. I mean, I think any polygamy novel is not going to be perceived as a Mormon story. But I think that I hope that we can read these novels as, wow, these are interesting people. And some of them tell the story well. Some of them tell them in not as artful ways. What can we think about these as a springboard to something else?
Thank you.
So that's a long way to say yes and no. How about that?
Anyone else have comments on second thoughts after hearing other people? Okay, well, let's hear from the audience. Go on, Ron.
No,
it's a free for all.
We're done.
Orson Whitney was a pretty bright guy. I don't know where he was in terms of his own time. And when he said what he said, it seems to me that what he said was may have had a more universal feeling than when President Kimball said what he said. When Orson Whitney talked about a Mormon literature, or a literature by Mormons, I like to think, at least given the quality of his own writing, that he might have had in mind a Mormon literature that had some universality about it, and that would appeal to the human family, and not just the Mormon family. And that's what I think Brady Udall has done. When I think of Mormon letters that appeal to Mormons or that appeal to helping Mormons and non-Mormons understand each other, it still seems to me that we're being in-house, you know? And yet, if we really do learn to become universal in our literary gifts to the world, it's going to help our missionary system if that's what we want. I think people are going to take us more seriously but I don't think that ought to be our goal. And I think the Brady Udalls, and for that matter, even the Maureen Triples and the Virginia Sorensons, a few of them have done it. And I loved some of the ideas that you gave us, Jane. I'll shut up.
That's lovely. Thank you.
Any comments? Well, let me ask one, springing off what you said. Brady Udall and Maureen Whipple and Virginia Sorensen, especially Vardis Fisher. Levi, to some degree.
Levi is certainly more in-house.
The point I want to make is they're on the margins of Mormonism.
Yeah.
You know, they're Orson Whitney, Spencer Kimball want faithful, believing people to tell the Mormon story.
Yeah.
Is it possible for a believing, true believing Mormon to tell a Mormon story effectively that communicates with a non-Mormon audience?
Probably not.
Any questions? Any panelists have comments on that?
I'm not sure that this is perfectly related to what you brought up in the audience and what you just said. But I think one of the reasons I'm interested in these novels about these subjects is I'm dying. I want the Mormons to help me understand why I'm so fascinated by them, and I feel I'm that there's just so much. They have so much magnetism, and that it's that. But I see the magnetism, especially in the clashes between non-Mormons and Mormonism, that there seems to be all this material in the places they don't get along and have actually almost often violently not gotten along. But I don't myself feel, I don't feel that I have the insight I need, and so I somehow have the sense that the Mormons can help me. That's
cool. Can I add something? Part of President Kimball's quote, you know, when he was calling for great Mormon masterpieces, he added this qualification: our motion picture specialists must be purified by the very best critics. So I would argue that if the very best critics are going to appreciate the stories. They have to be artful. And I think the distinction of whether or not you're believing or not is different than the writing art. And I use that quote from The New Yorker about texture as a way to get at that. The self-contradiction and error as well as you know. I'm not going to finish that. Will you guys just take over?
I just had a question for Jane. You said something very interesting to me, that you want Mormons to explain to you why you're so interested in them.
Is that fair?
That fascinates me. What is it about Mormons that interests you so much?
I feel that their great intensity in their lives, intensity in the and aspiration, that they have a kind of moral extremism, and that's maybe the wrong phrase, but a moral intensity, and yet, I feel that the non-Mormons have kind of played themselves out around certain themes that have gotten emptier and emptier. The self, maybe my life, my selfish life, the sort of what makes Sandy run, and other themes. But that in the persecution and in Missouri, that you see people. Actually, I would love a film about the Missouri Wars, because how was it that the Mormons were living? What was it that they were doing that got the whole thing, everyone so infuriated? I mean, there was just something in the way they walked down the street together or went off at the end of the day together that really annoyed people. And I feel like the whole thing about Joseph Smith creating this incredible controversy around himself. He was somebody who believed in God and saw God and knew. And just at the very time, when the New Englanders come and meet him, one of the prejudices they bring is that John Quincy Adams didn't like Emerson because he felt Emerson was going to try and start a new sect. And they were all Unitarians. And in fact, Joseph Smith had started a new sect. So that he didn't, even in a world of New England where God, Emerson spoke for bringing God back to earth, these guys didn't really like the man who brought God back to earth. So I feel that many of the things, many of the transcendent, emotional, irrational, earnest is not the word I'm using, but emotional, irrational, transcendent, elements in life are the Mormons have lived them and continue, very deeply. So that's what I find fascinating.
Okay, another question.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, in general, religious themes and faith themes are becoming less commonplace in literature and in film, and for better or worse. And, I mean, is that part of a reason why it's tough to break in this way? And, could someone, would Graham Greene writing today, if he were, writing about the Catholic experience, would people be reading him if he were a current author? I don't know. I mean, I'd like your opinions.
Well, Albert, I bet you have something great to say.
No, you go.
Go for it.
Honestly, I don't know. I feel like someone like Graham Greene just would make it fascinating again. I mean, that he brought his own moral difficulty. I have to actually think about the question. I don't know the answer.
I mean, we read Mary Gordon. I mean, there are plenty of novelists who are identified with a culture or with a religion that we read, but I'm not sure that we shove them into genres of faith-told stories. I think the ones who do it well, we read.
Well, actually, one thing about Graham Greene is that he also has within his books a doubting figure. So I think that maybe because I'm the doubting or the searching half of this the Mormon non-Mormon equation, the Mormons have. And I don't want to say that this is focus on your belief, because I know that you've got a book about the church. You would not want to read it. But anyways, I think Graham Greene would. read very suitable today because of his sense of the problem of belief as well as its power.
Yeah, I think that, I'm not sure, maybe you guys should bring that up, but to me that's the key, one of the key themes that would be in a great Mormon novel or a great Mormon movie is the issue of someone struggling with doubt and faith. And, I mean, to me that's something in the way a Graham Greene character does. And to me that would be a great Mormon novel if, yeah.
Well, I'll just say something about my take on religion and film today. I think that it's avoided, with exceptions like Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. But I think we're in an era of escapism when it comes to film, and that the box office rules. And you know, good films get out, but I think people want to avoid those questions when they go to the cinema.
Until it's done well.
Unless it's done extremely well, and every once in a while a film like that comes up. But try getting that through a Hollywood pitch session. You know, it's impossible to get, I mean, it's not impossible, but very difficult to get a film like that funded.
My favorite books, my favorite novels are those that address religious themes. As I think about John Steinbeck's East of Eden and it tackling a biblical verse, and as I think of Salinger's Franny and Zoe and its tackling of a biblical verse, and then I think about Mormonism, I wonder if the success of those novels, the readability of them, comes from the fact that the Bible in America can also be viewed just as literature. And it's been approached outside of a religious context. And I wonder if we have to wait until the Book of Mormon receives that same kind of broad, maybe secular acceptance, until a Mormon novel can have that kind of readability. And it's not going to be abrasive to a general readership. And maybe the development of Mormon studies programs at Claremont and at Yale and at Berkeley are kind of the forerunner to this. And maybe there will be a time when an East of Eden type book can be written on a Book of Mormon verse or a Doctrine and Covenants verse. I just wonder, my question is, can we leapfrog that? Can we anticipate that? Can we write a novel before the Book of Mormon receives a general readership or acceptance or a secular academic treatment?
That's a really fun question.
That's a great question.
Yeah. We can write it. Yeah. And we can write it, but I don't know if it would be read.
Well, you know, in America, I think we still approach the Koran, most secular America, the same way they do the Book of Mormon. It's a strange religious text from an alien religion. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to provide a little more context. It's back to your Wallace Stegner quote, like, it's too complicated of a story to explain, to make it a bestseller.
But there are all kinds of novels that I don't have any background about the history or culture of the people, and I read the novel because I love the story, mm-hmm. because I'm engaged in the story. And I think we're limiting ourselves if we say people have to understand us first. Understand us through fiction. And I'm saying that with great idealism, you know, instead of being at home right now at my computer writing my great American novel. So that's making me nervous. So I've taken the...
I do think that was a great question. Great observation. And but one thing I feel is that the Mormons need more a larger understanding in the wider culture. But I do think there's this problem with Joseph Smith, and that the Book of Mormon that he needs first to be sort of understood and seen, written, have a book written about him by Brady Udall, who can make, or whoever, that can help make him a character that is riveted to the country, and the country can understand why he's so riveting. Because the Book of Mormon, in a way, I mean, if people revere or admire or are, you know, taken by Joseph Smith, the Book of Mormon will come. But I think there's a, and partially, you know, I just think there's not enough understanding or not enough sense of Joseph Smith as American as he is, that the larger America doesn't view him that way.
There is, of course, a set of American novels about Joseph Smith by Scott Card, the Alvin Maker series, and they've had relative success in the fantasy field, but we've been avoiding genre fiction here. I don't know that they would, and they make him seem very human and interesting. I think they're very interesting novels, but, you know, it's a certain genre.
Jane's comment about the student and the teacher evoked a thought in my mind, and if I were a writer, which I'm not, and if I wanted to be excommunicated from the LDS Church, which I do not want, I would write a book about the split personality which exists in the Mormon psyche. And the split personality that I think about is the Mormons in my ward that I know in the gospel doctrine class, and the same Mormons that I go on vacation with for a week and have a chance to talk more freely than in a confined group, are to some extent two different people. And so the book I would write would be the Mormon's split personality.
Actually, just one question quickly for you. What are they like in the Gospel Principles class, and what are they like? What is the big difference?
Well, the difference is that in the group, everybody is very careful to say something that will be approved by all 30 people in the class. And on vacation, they're you and them together, and they're not thinking about how they're going to be regarded among the group. And so there's a different person on vacation.
That's a fun dynamic.
That's fascinating.
Ellen, you said you had things in threes, but I only heard you talk about two books.
I'll show you. The first one was my childhood, Wilderness Bride, which has a polygamy story. So I kind of tricked you with my three. Thank you, though.
And I'm interested in the way that you're talking about books. What I'm wondering is whether, as you said, it's hard to get movies made. Is it hard to get a book written, published, publicized about a woman's story? Because I think Mary Whipple's Giant Joshua and another one that I just recently read called Red Water are exceptionally better than a woman.
I would argue, I thought about including Red Water as well, but to me Red Water doesn't have some of the comic elements that make these, I think, more crossover tales. But I mean, it's a fascinating book and a really interesting, beautifully written story.
And I'm wondering about Richard Dutcher's movies. I think Brigham City was one that showed just ordinary folks in this Mormon context. So what do you have to say about his book?
What do I have to say about Richard Dutcher's work? I like a lot of it, and some of it I don't think is very successful. I like it when I don't feel a heavy hand from him. Sometimes I feel like his endings that he started the film with his ending and then just and work backwards, how am I going to get here? And I don't like that when I'm in the hands of a director that I feel is pushing something down my throat. I think some of his stuff has been very fresh. I think he's a very good filmmaker. It'd be interesting now that he's left Mormonism, it'll be interesting to see what he comes up with.
Okay, Will?
I was going to say that my basic observation is that if there is a Mormon Faulkner, he'll be female. Because the best Mormon writers are with the women who've written from the Mormon experience. And Judith Freeman was the prototypical example that I wanted to use. And she's gone beyond the limits of Mormonism and explored several different approaches. And I think Red Water is easily the finest Mormon novel. I have never read her. I'm a historian, so I read boring histories. But Margaret Young has written a book called El Salvador that I hear is a very, very powerful book.
What's it called?
El Salvador.
Oh,
Salvador. Now, is it a Mormon book? Mormon thing?
Yeah.
Overtly?
You understand it better if you know the Mormon behind it, but you can read it without that.
The Chinchilla Farm is a wonderful growing up in this culture, in this region. And that's another point that a lot of the really bad fiction that dominates so much Mormon writing doesn't have any connection to the place. And I think you're losing that sense in a lot of writing because modern life is so detached from any connection with nature and the real world. And that's where a lot of the great strength of classic writers come from. You get this sense of place out of Faulkner that is forgotten in so much contemporary fiction. And Judith Freeman evokes, makes the place a character, very powerful.
She does.
She does.
But I was struck, too, by the observation about, two observations, about we're going to have to wait for the Book of Mormon to command respect. And Karen's observation about Joseph Smith's story has been told as science fiction. Well, Joseph Smith can be seen as a science fiction writer, but he was a very bad science fiction writer. And the problem with the Book of Mormon is it is a young person's book. It was written by somebody with immense imagination and talent, but he didn't come up with a single story that matches a biblical story is going to pursue. The one gripping story is about murder and Nephi and his brothers and treachery, and that's clearly a psychological construct. But the prose and the narrative structure is boring, classically boring. And then to tack on this bizarre science fiction story at the very end with magic submarines lit by magic rocks. It tells the same story again. People get rich. No, they're poor, so they get rich, and they get corrupt because they're rich, and so God destroys them. And they get poor, so they get righteous again. And then when they get righteous, they get rich, and they get destroyed again, and finally they destroy everybody. This has to go on twice to make the point. But it's interesting, too, that science fiction permeates a lot of early Mormon writing. Parley P. Pratt wrote New York 1945 about going to this desolated sand spit where the great city of New York had stood. Mormonism is now triumphed in the rules of Rome. But until we have writers with the talent and the ability to look at the bigger world and touch on the bigger things. And to me, the only women who've approached that in dealing with Mormon things are the women.
Yeah.
And this.
Okay. Well, we're over time, so lady, ma'am, could you come up and express your comments?
Well, I'm a non-Mormon, and I
I've been doing Mormon history for 20 years, and I started knowing nothing, probably as you did, Jane. And it has taken me a long time to begin to understand the Mormon world. And it seems to me that there may be two types of fiction. And one is possible and one is not, or one is very, very difficult, and where Stegner would come in. And I think that one would be that if it's a social history, a Mormon in a situation, like Faulkner does with the Southerners, you can get into that story. It may not seem familiar to you or anything. Wasn't to me until I married a Southerner and suddenly became, oh. But when it comes to the theology, that's where I just think it is nearly impossible, because there's so many differences from American Protestantism or Catholicism or Judaism that the rest of Americans come with some basic understanding of. And then you go into this foreign country of Mormonism, and you could be in Tibet. You know, it's just so different. So I just think it would be quite possible as a social, about a Mormon family or situation, really hard on when it comes to theology. But of course, they would overlap.
Yeah. That's great. Well, thank you very much, and thank everyone for coming. Thank you.